had another manned mission at the toward the end of the month on the 19th by Endeavour. I can give you some details about that. Back you there.
Am I hearing November 2, Juliet Papa Zulu? And if I got the call letters correct, is that you, Gerald? Go ahead.
So that's the Juliet Papa Zulu.
Okay, the signal you're giving us is 90% noise, 10% audio. Extremely weak signal. I don't think, unless you can find a better location, we're going to make a go. Let me go back to the space report, and then we'll come back to you for another try. The very next launch, I think, is the, maybe the very last launch of a space shuttle, and that's the one that's going to have this very high-energy cosmic ray detecting device that's going to be installed on the International Space Station. When is that launch likely to happen, if you happen to know, Paul? And I think you said you had another report to give us. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, this is WS2N. Is that the one with the alpha magnetic spectrometer? Is that the one you're talking about that's going to look for dark matter and all? That's this light there.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about, the alpha. you're saying that has been displayed. I missed the very last sentence. What did you say? That has been blank. Over to you, Paul.
No, that is this mission. This mission that is going up. That'll be attached to the truss section, probably about 100 feet out from the center. And they'll have a couple of spacewalks for that. It's a pretty big piece of equipment. You know, you hear these names, and then when you look at it, you say, "Wow, that's a big thing they're going to put onto that truss." And that's going to look for dark matter and antimatter and all of that. So, and this is the flight where you bring in the Endeavour. Congressman woman that she was shot, the husband, Kelly, he's the commander of it. Six fellows are going to be going up on this flight. They're bringing things up, big things that they won't be able to bring up easily in the future, a big ammonia tank, an extra ammonia tank, attaching that. Other additional equipment. There's this gigantic robot that's on the outside of the space station. That thing needs equipment, possible replacement, so they'll attach that to the space station. You've got the... interesting enough, they're going to leave behind a 50-foot arm of the... every shuttle mission has this... Well, this is the fourth one, has this gigantic arm that's built by Canada. We drop it. They're not going to need that on the Endeavour anymore. It's the last flight for Endeavour. So they're going to leave that behind, attached to the space station. It'll serve as an independent arm or attached to the existing robotic arm that's attached to the space station. It's called Canada Arm 2. That's the one that attached to the space station. And Canada Arm 1 is the one set up built put into the space shuttle. But there is going to be one more flight after this. There is one more, so we'll hope it's not more. So we'll be looking forward to that one as well. But this is the last one for Endeavour. Back to you.
And you said it, Mel, but I missed it. Paul. Endeavour is going to be taking this alpha magnetic spectrometer, I think it is, this one that's looking for this really potent cosmic rays. In other words, every cosmic ray detector we have ever put into space periodically gets saturated. Something stronger than it can really measure comes along. So they're putting up this machine now that can really measure the strong ones. And so that's going to give them a lot more information. So Endeavour is likely to leave the launch pad at approximately what day, Paul? Go ahead.
That's scheduled this month for the 19th. And right now they have crews that are searching the shuttle right now. You know, it's out of the launch facility. fact, they've had the crew go on board for a practice simulated launch already. So they're getting ready. And the crews that are out there searching for damage. You know, there was a big storm that went through Florida over the weekend, and they want to make sure that none of those lightning bolts got a hold of that space shuttle or the tank or anything, you know. So they're going over that with a fine-tooth comb. Any problems, you know, there'll be a delay, of course. You know, you have some of these lightning strikes that have hit the shuttle on pad in the past, of course, caused a fortune, because you have to bring the space shuttle back to the vehicle assembly building to work on it instead of scaffolding and do some repairs. So hopefully all is well there. The last flight was delayed many months because of cracks in the tank, not related to the lightning, but other problems. So who knows, you know, right now it's scheduled for the 19th of this month. Back to you. We got a flight tomorrow from Kazakhstan, the Baikonur, that put three people up. So you have a constant crew of six on the space station. Back to you, WS-2M.
Yeah, tell me, how many are on the space station right now? Three more are going up from Baikonur tomorrow, and will that mission be bringing any back down? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, they don't do it like that. In other words, there's a Soyuz spacecraft attached to the International Space Station now. So what will happen is, you'll have a crew. They'll leave. Three will leave. And then another three will be going up. So they'll disconnect. And then the other one will go up. The other one will come down, you know, independently. So it's kind of the way it works. A lot of times, most of the times you'll have two Soyuz spacecraft attached to the space station. The mission rules are, you know, if you have three people up there, or how many other people, you have to have that many seats ready to go back. So if you have six people on board, that means you have two Soyuz spacecraft attached to the space station. That's what you have now. So one will back out, it'll come back down, and the other one attaches in a couple of days. It takes roughly two and a half, three days for a launch, after launch, to attach to the space station. So that's pretty much the way it goes there.
How many astronauts and cosmonauts are on the International Space Station right now, Paul? And if there were six there now, and you're bringing up three, does that mean temporarily there'll be nine people on board? Over to you, Paul.
They've had a lot more than that up there. You know, they've had, I think, as much as 13, 14 at one time. The three will be leaving. I think they leave tomorrow as well, and then they'll be coming back. And then in a couple of days, the one that launches tomorrow will be docking. So, yeah, last time I checked, which was this morning, it says you always bring up NASA, and you bring up NASA International Crew, and they'll tell you exactly who's on board. Last time I checked, it's six. Back to you, Dave.
So, if I understand you correctly, three will be leaving before the new ones come up. Is that true, Paul?
That's what I read. They're calling it Expedition 27. Gets kind of confusing because 27 is going up, but yet 27, part of 27 is leaving, so I don't know, that always gets kind of confusing when you read the numbers, but they show the crew that's leaving, and they show the crew that's going up, so that's the way they do it. And sometimes you'll get a shuttle that will go up there, and they'll have six people on board, and you bring up a shuttle with another six, and then next thing you know, you have 12 or 13 people temporarily on board that station. So it can handle it. What are you? You've got like 10, 12, equivalent of 10 or 12 rooms, people to hang out in. Plenty of room there.
Yeah, but there could be a little bit of a rush. What's the total number of operational toilets on board, Paul? Go ahead.
I have two now. And when the shuttle goes up, of course, there's three up there. So it's not too bad. For a long time they had one, but then when they increased the crew to six, there was a mad rush to get that second one working. So, there you go. The Soyuz spacecraft are really not equipped for that, you know. So, but the space shuttle is. Might be a problem in the future, you know. You've got the Dragon spacecraft that's going to be put online eventually. That's a private company. And hopefully they have a nice bathroom on that thing too, because, you know, that will be bringing six people up at a time about 4 years down the road from now. So, you know, you'll generally have two bathrooms on the space station, and hopefully on the new vehicle that's being built on. They'll make sure they have one on that. So three at a time when you have large crews on the space station. So it's not like years ago. You know, they had a real great system for the Skylab. They had a big you could take showers. It was a facility for showers. You don't have that on board the space station.
Yeah, I think they have to do everything with moistened towels, is that true?
Yeah. But I mean, they had this thing rigged up on a Skylab, and it was this big, round, flexible thing that went all the way around your back body, and, you know, they pulled it up, tethered it off, and they had a functioning shower. But that didn't work out too good. There were all kinds of problems with that. Bubbles going all over and everything else. But they put an end to that. And took up quite a bit of room.
I understand. Okay, thank you for the information, Paul. Let's give one more try to N2 Juliet Papa Zulu is what it sounded like. Let's see if we can hear your signal. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe he's gone. John, KC2WGB, I know that you were about to do a sensitivity test of another one of your 2-meter rigs that's in the house. I wonder how that worked out, John. Kind of curious. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Maybe John's not there. And maybe Wesley can tell us. And Wesley, you had me look at something called the ferroelectric capacitor, triglycine sulfate, as a nonlinear capacitor. And looks like that's got some very interesting properties. N2XJN, K2RAW. You got it, Wesley.
N2XJN. Good evening, everybody. Yes, I do have a problem with that, as a ferroelectric capacitor is the device that could take a high voltage, could store it, and could align dipoles, can align dipoles and keep the memory. That's why one of the first ferromagnetic capacitors was used in the first stage of the computer age. And that's how the computers retain their memory. But the problem with that is that there is a notion standing that you have two stages in ferroelectric capacitor. One of them is high current, low voltage, and the other one is low current, high voltage. At the same device, at the same very time, as this capacitor is highly nonlinear. Now, the strange thing is And I would appreciate if somebody give me the information that this capacitor is being characterized, only the capacitor that I'm talking about, with very square-like hysteresis. And there is the manufacturer that manufactures exactly this type of the capacitors, but he has an agreement with U.S. Navy. And when the number of people approached that manufacturer, they told that they are not allowed to sell this non-classified element to the public or to the commercial use. So I was just wondering. And I spent a lot of time, and I have sent to Glenn Dick large amount of links and information about everything that in regards to the ferroelectric capacitor. So I would like you guys to take a stand, and then I will be translating, relating to that what you say. And to Asia.
I didn't get a chance to study the material for the right length of time, Wesley. But what little I see is that one of the YouTube videos you sent me showed me how to build one of those in front of an electric heater. I have the impression that this multi-state, nonlinear ferroelectric capacitor behaves quite differently depending on what temperature it is at. I think it's 322 degrees Kelvin or something like that was the temperature at which it flips over from one mode of operation to another mode of operation. And so multi-state devices, things that at one voltage or at one temperature behave one way, and at another voltage and another temperature they behave another way, nonlinear characteristics are capable of chaotic performance. They're capable of acting as magnetic amplifiers. I guess they're capable of storing information in the early days of memory devices. And nowadays with the, I can't even think of the name of the kind of memory devices that we're using nowadays, flash memories, we're getting ridiculously high density of data in a non-volatile memory techniques by way of flash memory. These flash drives and these little dongles that we use hold an awful lot of information in a very small package. My goodness, have we come a long way from the days when, let me drop. I remember at the very beginning, the home computer enthusiast would buy a Sinclair computer or something like that, and for some relatively large number of dollars, you could buy 20,000 bits of more memory information storage. We used to buy memories at 20K bits. Now we'd like to buy memory at 20 gigabits. That's 20K bits. We're only a million times higher, or is it a billion times higher, in memory capacity these days compared to the way it was in the beginning. The world of computers are really moving fast. When it comes to handheld devices, I think I told you guys last week or the week before last, I was at a party where somebody was demonstrating his 3G or 4G telephone to me, his wireless telephone-like thing. And he was showing me all those applications and how wonderful it is. And I asked him, do you realize how much infrastructure there is behind the scenes maintaining all of those functions? To which he said, what are you talking about? It's in my hand. I just paid $300 for it. I said, you've already got 1% of the network in your hand. The other 99% is all that very elaborate chunk of electronics that's located at all those cell sites. He didn't believe me. He thought the thing in his hand was doing all the work. So there's a genius behind the scenes here. That's the Wizard of Oz, what do they call that? There's a wizard behind the scene. There's something behind the curtain that's really doing all the work. And an awful lot of the people nowadays don't recognize that. You talk to a modern-day student about a tape recorder, a 33 RPM hi-fi record, a video cassette recorder. They don't understand any of these words. The world has changed. So from your understanding, the Ferro
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
The ferroelectric capacitor, with its nonlinear characteristics, where it's got this hysteresis curve that looks sort of like a diamond shape. And by the way, when you have a saturable core reactor, when you have a magnetic circuit that saturates and it gives you a hysteresis curve, you also end up with this rectangular-looking thing. And it can be used in various ways to process data, to possibly act as a memory device. In the case of a high hysteresis magnetic device, you're capable of making a magnetic amplifier out of it. And in World War II and soon after that, a large number of high-power servo mechanisms were using magnetic amplifiers. They're not as popular today because we've got operational amplifiers and high-power transistors and silicon-controlled rectifiers and silicon-controlled switches and things like this that do the functions in a much smaller package, and the great big bulky magnetics seems not to be required anymore with the modern-day servo mechanisms. So have you got an impression as to what is the potential application for a ferroelectric capacitor? I didn't get far enough in the reading to find that out yet, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. But a problem that I have with it is that in non-linear ferroelectric capacitor, there is a three major non-linear process involved. So it is possible to carefully choose and arrange conditions so that the current through the capacitor moves against the voltage across the terminals. And then switching edge timing with some consideration to resonance effect, in the theory, it is possible to use highly non-linear effects in the circuits and try to treat it as the, how should I explain it? I would say overpotential at the terminals of the battery and reaction from ferroelectric capacitors, that's one of the stage. Consequent recharging of the battery via back potential battery side while the load is still being powered, that's the third stage. The first one would be the consequent driving of the load of the load side of the terminals. So I know I'm able to explain this properly, but by bypassing ferroelectric capacitor across the terminals of the battery, I should say a different way. Let me hold on. And to XJN. What I think is that there is absolutely no conservation of energy load that requires that energy input to dissipate as much as energy as does the load circuit that receives the energy to power it. So why we think only those mixing circuits that will indeed force equal input dissipation, we need three things in the input: lots of voltage, lots of current, and small energy dissipation. Okay, now I've got it. That means that we need voltage-like input and current-like input, and we have that within the same stage of that nonlinear capacitor. And then it will interact with each other on the input side of the mixer. Then we need a mixer that will mix these two into a single signal with high voltage and high current, but will not back couple its fields into input circuit to up input dissipation. In other words, it is a kind of mystery trying to obtain the S-curve ferroelectric capacitors, but it will give us the two stages. One is low voltage, high current. The other one is high voltage, low current. And as we take one of them with the mixer and the second one with the mixer as an input, and we put them together, then we actually are able to edge both of these factors and to create a power without creating unnecessary back EMF. This is what I was trying to say. Back to you.
In the case of a hysteresis curve that you get from a magnetic circuit where partial saturation is taking place, the so-called BH curve, where the horizontal axis may be ampere turns of magnetic excitation you give the circuit, and the vertical axis might be the magnetic field that results, and as you put a sine wave-like signal into that, you trace out this diamond-shaped hysteresis curve. And the area inside the curve represents dissipation, represents energy loss. If I did the same thing and carefully plotted the way the water behaves in my microwave oven, I've got a similar characteristic where the magnetron tube is creating a instantaneous voltage or current or magnetic field or electromagnetic field, call it what you like, but I'm creating an excitation which is causing the water molecule, which is a dipole molecule, to flip back and forth, but it does so with a phase delay. So with the right kind of a plot, let me drop. My water molecule in my microwave oven also has a hysteresis curve. There's a curve where on the way up it traces one line, on the way down it traces another line, and there's area between those two lines on the way up and the way down on each half cycle of, let's call it magnetization or voltage excitation, you could call it what you like. And the area in that curve represents the loss of energy that becomes the heat of a water molecule. And that's the major thing that's going on in my microwave oven. I'm heating up the water molecules, and that's 90-some-odd percent of what's doing the cooking of my food. Now, with this ferroelectric capacitor, which in one of the YouTube videos, it showed me a hysteresis curve, and I believe that that curve represents a dissipation of energy, that heating is taking place within that ferroelectric capacitor because it is tracing out that diamond-shaped curve. The way up and the way down is not retracing the exact same path. So energy loss mechanisms, I think, are possibly being displayed. And another thing to worry about is that, be excited about is that when I've got a change in state versus voltage that is capable of parametric amplification, is capable of gain in voltage, a gain in power, and so you can see that there's opposite things going on. The hysteresis curve normally represents power dissipation, but nonlinearities used the correct way in a parametric amplifier can represent maybe not an energy gain, but a voltage gain. You can do voltage boosting. A parametric amplifier does that. It has some of the characteristics of pushing somebody on a swing, and with small amounts of push, you build up significant amounts of energy.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You build up a significant amount of energy after a certain period of time. To your knowledge, has the ferroelectric capacitor been used in a circuit that has, where the circuit itself does something that's very desirable, that's very difficult to do by any other means? Do you know of a place where the ferroelectric capacitor has been applied to do a useful function? I haven't read enough into the articles that you submitted to me yet to find that. Over to you, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. Well, ferroelectric capacitor has been used by Department of Defense and by Department of Energy. And the application is microwave. The application is also creating a memorizable stages of the devices In other words, a new trend for the hard drives and memorizing the information is being in progress to be delivered using the ferroelectric materials. Now, what I would like to do is, if you can explain to others how do we, what is the hysteresis, and how do we obtain the hysteresis, and what devices do we use for to measure the hysteresis. But one thing that I would like to mention, let me drop. MacLean and Wooden patented a great little magnetic resonance amplifier system based on the application of Dr. Robert Brass. Now, I got to mention, 99% of the links that I have sent you are very much reputable links from the highest possible level of professionals and laboratories. Now, these guys, they had exceptional knowledge and experience, and Mr. Wooden wrote the patent for these guys, and for that he was prosecuted, unjustly attacked, and suffered financial difficulties. And he was not forgiven as a highly qualified scientist who took the series of interest in perpetual motion machines as permissible in Maxwellian dissipative systems, and he got burned. After the technical discussion back and forth, the patent office notified Mr. Wooden and MacLean.
Welcome to the Wesley Nat. This is Wesley Nat.
The Wooden, that the patent has been accepted and the patent would be issued within days. Their consternation grows to the fact that the patent was rejected, and that was the end of that. So I would name it, in another words, the fix was in. My understanding is that we know about ordinary nonlinear mixing and mixers.
Welcome to the Wesley Net. Everybody else shut the hell up and listen to the Pollock.
Okay, and to XGN. Waiting for the people.
Welcome to the Wesley Net. Everybody else shut the hell up. Listen to Pollock speaking.
Okay, now increase the power. I got confused. Would you please, Dick, just explain to the audience what is the hysteresis and what it represents and how we obtain that? And to actually...
I know how to make a hysteresis curve in the case of a magnetic circuit where I can measure the current that I'm putting in to the coil of the magnetic circuit. I know how many turns it's got. Therefore, I can interpret that current into ampere turns, and that can become the horizontal axis. By way of a Hall effect device or other kinds of magnetic detecting devices, I can find out what is the resulting magnetic field, and I can plot that as the vertical axis on a XY plot. And now, as I put a sinusoidal-like waveform into that network, the ampere turns horizontal and the resulting magnetic field vertical. When you plot that out, you get this characteristic hysteresis curve. In other words, it's sort of the magnetic field on the way up lags, and it also lags on the way down, and as such, the way up and the way down do not retrace the exact same position on the chart, and you end up with this diamond-shaped plot which has area in between the upgoing curve and the downgoing curve. The area inside that hysteresis plot, I think, represents energy loss. And you can make a similar plot, I believe, although I haven't seen one, to the way water behaves in a microwave oven. So knowing the input-output characteristics of your magnetic circuit or anything else that displays hysteresis can represent energy dissipation. If I take a Schmidt trigger, if I take an operational amplifier and use the right kind of feedback so that it acts as a Schmidt trigger, let me drop. I can also electronically make a hysteresis curve where the horizontal axis is input voltage and the vertical axis represents an output response of the Schmidt trigger-like circuit. And again, I can come up with a curve which has area inside of it, if you know what I mean. The upgoing curve and the downgoing curve are displaced from each other. And I've never heard anyone talk about the energy dissipated within a Schmidt trigger. And maybe there isn't, because that's a very low-level signal going on the input, and because of the feedback, it's got this slightly nonlinear characteristic on its output. That's about as much as I know about a hysteresis curve plotting procedure. And it does give you the various energy states, or the state variables, or whatever, as a analog plot. And so with the right kind of oscilloscope or similar display device, XY plotter, you can characterize your network. And I think on that YouTube video, when the guy on the electric heating element was developing his homemade ferroelectric capacitor, and then he applied voltage to it, you did see an oscilloscope display that showed that characteristic hysteresis curve. He also showed the way the characteristic curve changed as a function of temperature. I have the impression that this ferroelectric substance that's called triglycine sulfate is very temperature sensitive. At a particular temperature, it behaves one way, and at another temperature, it behaves another way. And so by using that characteristic, I'm guessing there's various ways of applying that to a useful circuit. Is that a misimpression on my part? I'm making some guesses before I've done all the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm doing some guessing before I've done all the reading, as you can tell. I've had a very busy week, and I'm going to have another busy week coming up. The project I'm on is going through a critical phase. Over to you, Wesley. W2XJ and 2XJN, K2RIW and the TechNet. And by the way, do you know if John's going to be on tonight? Over to you, Wesley.
Interesting. John is in with us, but he has a problem with his voice, and he's just listening. Now, for electric ceramics, why do you use as capacitor transducers and transistors? And about one half of cells of electroceramic components of today is based on the ferroelectric material, but only a portion of it. Now, the ferroceramic materials are not ferroelectric capacitors. That's we're gonna make the distinction in here. Let me drop. Ferroelectric materials are being used to manufacture the capacitors. Now, you can apply 10,000 volts to this capacitor. And the good thing about it is that when you have a frequency in within megahertz and gigahertz, you can retain a steady dipole direction after you remove the voltage. It just memorizes that. Apart from that, it does react as a storage. When you apply the frequency of kilohertz, mainly 20 kilohertz and lower, it does not retain the memory, but it does very much significantly increase the two momentums, one of the low voltage and the high current, and one of the high current and low voltage at the same very time. All we need is just a mixer. No. The actuators in mechanics, sensors, the memory, like RAM memory, that's what they try to apply these capacitors right now and the material. But at the same time, energy-saving devices. Now, there is a very little knowledge about this kind of materials rapidly approaching, especially very much sponsored by the Department of Defense applications. I have sent you the materials and I have pointed a few things. I'm just trying to get into that. That was... okay, one of the things. X-rays. X-rays penetrate right through the materials, so we can look deep inside electronic devices, and ferroelectric capacitors are being utilized for that purpose. Now, yes, there is a fatigue that is appearing due to the temperature, and it was observed in regimes of polarization field hysteresis loop collapsed after repeat cycling with waves pulses at 1 kHz. Low electric field fatigue was observed within 10^4 pulses, talking about the frequency, at the layer structure, and could be restored by exposure to higher field pulses. So by modulating the level of the voltage, we are able to change the state of the device. Once we want to have this device to memorize something, we just higher the voltage, increase the voltage. Now, if we want this to return to non-memorizable state, we just lower the voltage. Absolutely amazing stuff. So, switches. I have sent you also the link which is sending about ferroelectric materials being used as switches. And when I said the X-ray can penetrate right through the material so we can look deep inside electronic devices, question then is, do we deal with some X-ray effects on or ultraviolet effects when we use the spark? The spark was primarily the primary thing that was utilized by Nikola Tesla, and I'm experimenting with that as well. How much of the X-ray and how much of ultraviolet do we have in spark? If you can explain to me. Back to you.
Yeah, that I don't know. I do know that they make it. Obvious by the fact, I've got some sparking machines, and when you look at them in a dark room, I know that they're emitting ultraviolet, probably X-rays, and I haven't used any instrumentation to confirm that yet. What really happens in a high voltage arc in air is a very interesting process. It's an avalanche-like process of the way the individual air molecules break down, primarily due to the velocity of the freed up electrons that are flowing in the arc itself. The reason why air breaks down at a particular voltage is because a cosmic ray comes along, frees up an electron. If the voltage is high enough, that freed up electron gets a chance to build up a high enough velocity so that when it strikes the next air molecule, it does an impact ionization. It strikes it with enough energy to break away another electron of the next air molecule and maybe two electrons, and you start an avalanche process. And that partially explains why air behaves opposite from common sense. Let me drop. If I increase the air pressure, and therefore the air molecules are packed closer together to each other, common sense would lead you to believe they're going to break down at a lower voltage. it does the exact opposite. Double the air pressure, and you double the dielectric strength, the breakdown voltage. Goes from 30,000 volts per centimeter to 60,000 volts per centimeter at 2 atmospheres. That's because the air molecules packed closer together are such that the mean free path, or free electron, becomes a smaller number. Goes from 63 nanometers down to 30-some-odd nanometers, 31.5 nanometers. Therefore, the freed-up electron doesn't get enough chance to build up enough velocity before it strikes the next air molecule. Therefore, it takes twice the voltage to do that. And so, when the impact ionization takes place, I'm reasonably sure that X-rays, ultraviolet, and things like this are given off. I think I do remember someone making a spark, a Curlian photography or something like that, making a spark in front of photographic-sensitive materials, even X-ray-sensitive materials and ultraviolet-sensitive materials, that can confirm that those energy wavelengths do exist in a spark. It's got lots of energy and lots of different frequencies. So, the way a spark behaves with positive voltage versus negative voltage is also interesting. In other words, if the two electrodes that are creating the spark have a different diameter to them. In other words, the positive electrode is a large diameter and the negative electrode is a small diameter. You'll get one breakdown voltage, and if you just simply reverse the polarity, you'll get an entirely different breakdown voltage. If you make the smallest probe the one that is positively charged, you'll get the highest breakdown voltage. And that's just the way the E field around that probe forms, and the fact that the electrons have much higher mobility than do the protons that are left over. You take a air molecule, it could be a nitrogen molecule or an oxygen molecule, and you strip away a electron. You've now created an ionized material. The electron is free to move toward the positive terminal. The resulting proton is free to move toward the negative terminal. But the proton, the nucleus, is a much heavier object. It moves much more slowly. Therefore, it's got very different characteristics when it's moving toward a large versus a small diameter electrode. So when you study the way a Wimshurst machine works and you aim the probes in a particular manner, you'll get very different breakdown voltages and very different lengths of spark. When you do it in the wrong direction, you hear a whole lot of corona discharge, and the machine never gets a chance to build up a high voltage to give you a nice spark. These are some of the things that I've discovered. High voltage is fun stuff. If you just simply Google the word high voltage and high voltage experiments, you'll find a whole lot of articles written on the subject where people have built very high power Tesla coils and other kinds of machinery. So there's quite a number of ham-like people out there that are exposed.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's quite a few ham-like enthusiasts out there that are experimenting with high voltage, and quite a few of them have videos and YouTube videos showing you what they've done and the way it behaves. I know I haven't really answered your question. I'm reasonably sure ultraviolet and X-ray is present. I don't know how much. I'm reasonably sure it obeys some kind of a law in which you use larger capacitors that give you a stronger discharge when it occurs, and I'm reasonably sure that more energy at the higher frequency spectrum will take place, the shorter wavelengths. That's my belief, but I haven't actually proven it. But I bet you we could do some research on that. Let me break subjects for a second here, Wesley. To your knowledge, did John get a chance to measure any of his other receivers, and did he come up with a similar sensitivity on his Gigatronics signal generator when he was doing 20 decibel noise quieting of an FM receiver? N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
As far as I know, John wasn't feeling well yesterday, and he was preparing himself to do the test. He was trying to He did the test with three of his other transceivers, and all of them came to the same, and it is simply impossible that all of three of them are damaged. Some of them, one of them is completely unused, as far as I remember. Now, before we change the subject, I just want to make a summary of that for the people. As we are approaching the birth of the new device, so we had the transistor, we had the diodes, we have capacitors and many others, but we didn't have the device that is able to memorize. There is a name for it. I just don't recall it. I put it into the email for it, memorize or something like that. And a memorizer, I just don't remember that. So, we have a ferrocapacitor that is able to retain the stage as a permanent memory, but could be reprogrammed immediately using the frequency and voltage. So it does have a frequency response. Then the ferro material with permanent dipoles cannot be used in microwaves. That's another thing. And then it does have permittivities at low frequencies of kilohertz. Another thing, permanent dipole reorientation can flow only at megahertz and gigahertz. Ferroelectric capacitor can store more electric charge due to dielectric polarization. And I just don't know, I've seen the material, what is the difference between elastic energy, which is V class, and dipole direction, which is V deep, and that combined equals total energy. What is elastic energy, if you could tell me, and then we change the subject into a shift.
I'm not sure I know what elastic energy is. If I'm stretching a rubber band or compressing a rubber ball, I could call that energy I put in elastic energy, and it's not too different than stretching a spring or compressing a spring. I'm putting energy into it, and if the spring or the rubber ball or the rubber band is high enough in quality, when I relax it, I tend to get that same amount of energy back. Maybe a little bit of loss, but I tend to get the energy back. So that's my first guess as to what elastic energy is. When it comes to voltage being applied to a circuit and something there being defined as elastic energy, I'm not familiar with that yet. You're going to have to educate me on this one, Wesley. So I presume it's voltage applied versus the response, that some portion of that's called electric energy. And by the way, if the ferroelectric capacitor has memory characteristics, I wonder how useful memory is these days when you've got these super micro miniature things called flash memories where you can put gigabytes into very small packages. That alone would not make a ferroelectric capacitor as a memory device wouldn't sound like it's very valuable. And by the way, the fact that it behaves one way with microwaves applied and a different way with very low frequencies applied, my first guess what's going on there is because it's got this hysteresis loop characteristic, and in most circumstances, a hysteresis loop, when you apply a sine wave to a material, represents energy loss proportional to the area inside of a hysteresis loop. So if I apply microwave energy to something that has a hysteresis loop, most likely heating is taking place. If heating is taking place, I'm raising the temperature of the ferroelectric capacitor material. And the article, and some of the articles you've shown me so far, that I've seen so far, show you that it changes characteristic as the function of temperature. So a microwave excitation could create a different temperature, which creates a different characteristic as opposed to doing it at the kilohertz. Is there any possibility that the crazy guess of mine is what's going on here, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Victor David Henry with a comment.
Victor David Henry. Start off with your full call and your name, and then your comment, sir.
Okay, fine. This is Dick. Yeah, the handle is John. The call is WA2 Victor David Henry. Just listening on this this ferroelectric capacitor, I think this substance is one where the permittivity of the material is a tensor. In other words, electric field applied, say, in the X direction causes a different D field in the Y direction. I think this is sort of the analogy of what a ferrite does when it has a magnetic field on it, where the permeability becomes a tensor quality. Back to that.
And to extend. I would appreciate if John could, if Dick could explain how that video was done and how physically that device was made. I found that equation, and that equation that relates to the elastic energy is exactly the term that applies to the ferroelectric capacitor. And it is based on the first approximation of linear relation of temperature, well known that was Curie-Wells law, and it was discussing the dipole interaction of the ferroelectric materials and why the hysteresis changes. Then we have that elastic energy that has these two stages that I was mentioning to, and then you have a total energy. The problem that the people have is they're trying to make that hysteresis, the characteristic of the ferroelectric materials to be linear, which is almost impossible, as opposed to take advantage of non-linearity of stages and try to get the most of it. The direction to make it a power device is not really very much researched. It's like it looks like something is holding in this area, apart from the applications for the army. I have got about 16 different information about the grant from Department of Energy. And to XJN. Back to Dick.
Right now, Wesley, I'm not sure what your question is, and I might not have anywhere near enough smarts to answer it. Could you reword what you're questioning, Wesley? Go ahead.
And to XJN. I'm sorry, I still have a problem with my English, but I'm trying to do best. I remember myself when I was a year ago trying to enter TechNet. Anyhow, the thing is that we're dealing with the factors of elastic energy, which is the energy that changes its state due to the hysteresis and the temperature of that material. My question was, would you be able to describe how physically the gentleman from the video, which is the PhD of Berkeley University, if I remember correctly, how was he physically able to make that capacitor, and how does hysteresis look like? Back to you.
My slight understanding of watching that video where he was pouring the raw powdery yellow material onto what became the capacitor plates, and he put that on an electric heating coil, heating element, while I presume applying voltage to those plates. And so the oscilloscope display he got, I think, was a VI curve. In other words, the horizontal axis maybe was voltage and the vertical axis was current. And so he's plotting the voltage applied to the capacitor plates, the current that is required to get that voltage onto the capacitor plates, and probably something like a